Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Theodore Blank for Mr. Nason. I'm going to attempt to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. My plan, unless the court steers me in a different direction, is to briefly address the constructive amendment argument and then turn to the sentencing argument. With respect to the constructive amendment argument, the government charged Mr. Nason with assault through, quote, shooting in the direction of, end quote, a federal deputy. That language charged only the attempted battery prong of assault. Because
why
that
is that? I read your argument. I've been trying to figure out why that does not encompass a threat. If somebody shoots a gun in your direction and they don't hit you, they could still be trying to threaten you. It seemed like the factual allegation in the indictment covered pretty much precisely what happened here.
Well, because in the direction of connotes an aiming at or shooting toward an intent to strike. Obviously, there's some imprecision in the charging language because he didn't actually strike him. But my argument is that language.
Why is that necessarily true? That's the part I didn't follow. Like, in theory, you would, you know, if birds, let's say I don't want to shoot you, but I want to threaten you and scare you away or something, I could shoot a gun in your direction. And if I actually hit you, I'd be like, oh no, I didn't mean to hit him. I just meant to threaten him. I don't know the way that necessarily follows, and that seems like your argument turns on that.
Well, it does turn on that, and I have, if the court is not persuaded that shooting in the direction of means shooting toward or at.
Trying to hit.
Trying to hit.
Shooting in the direction means trying to hit, which means something other than a threat. That's your,
it means
just trying. Yeah.
That's my argument, that it means aiming at. If I'm driving in the direction of, or I'm driving in your direction, I'm driving toward you or to you. There's some distance, but that's what that connotes.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's
you could
what
do the same thing. If I was trying to scare you, drive towards you, but I plan to, like, you know, not actually hit you, right? I mean, and so I'm threatening you by driving.
Well, I think, you know, I cite the dictionary definitions that it's an aiming. Direction of is, it connotes an aiming at, and that's the precision of the language. So that's the error argument, and my prejudice argument is strong, obviously, because the government argued that Mr. Nason could, the jury could convict Mr. Nason of the threat prong, explicitly argued that. Turning to the sentencing argument. The district court here erred by adopting the district court's incorrect guideline interpretation that the guideline for a violation, not the violation or this violation of 18 U.S. Code 111 is sentencing guideline 2A2.2. And I have, I guess, two levels to this procedural error argument. The first level is that the district court, in adopting the PSR's incorrect statement, misstated or adopted an incorrect version of the law. And this is the indefinite article argument, that the most common reading of the PSR, the length, what it would have meant to somebody just picking it up and reading it, is that a violation.
But did the district court ever say, I'm adopting the language of the PSR, and something to indicate that the district court was had done more than read the PSR and then went on to the sentencing and to determine that the which guideline applied without objection or argument from counsel?
It made the sort of generic statement that it was adopting the PSR as its own findings and conclusions,
but never said something along the lines of this particular guideline applies as opposed to the other because of, and you know, because it's the only one that can apply, which it seems to be your argument that the district court was under a misapprehension that only one of these two guideline sections could apply.
Correct. And it certainly didn't say that. That's sort of the second level of the procedural argument, is even if there's some sort of ambiguity in the language of the PSR, or it's not expressing this misconception of the commentary to 2A2.2, it never acknowledges, or there's nothing in the record that suggests that the district court recognized that there was a choice being made. The PSR doesn't connote that, so that doesn't put the court on notice. It adopts it without question. It doesn't say anything in the sentencing that suggests otherwise.
I mean, another aspect here is that there was no objection at the time of the sentencing, and certainly if there had been, then the district court could have made clear if there was a concern about that. So doesn't that factor in here?
I mean, it does. I'm on plain error review now. There's no doubt about that. But the error, I think, is plain. It's a mistake for the district court to say that this is the guideline for a violation.
And but if we look at this record and we conclude that it reasonably could be construed as that's what happened, or it also could reasonably be construed that the district court understood that there were two here and that it just chose the one that it chose. If that's what we conclude that the record shows, then where does that leave us for plain error review?
I think if you conclude that you can interpret this as the district court making a determination between the two, I would lose. But I don't think you can conclude that. Another lens to look at it is Cardi says that the district court has to explain sufficient to permit meaningful appellate review. And the government doesn't point to anything in the record that suggests that the district court recognizes that there's a threshold factual finding that's required by the guideline that it is in fact making in this case. It just adopts a misstatement and proceeds to sentence as if that's accurate. So there's sort of a misstatement of what the standard is on the common reading of the PSR. There's never any utterance by the district court that suggests, I understand that there's a choice being made here. There's never a citation to the guideline commentary that's kind of guiding this. And there's never a factual finding that would be what drives this. Another way that, my argument would be weak if in this PSR it had cited to that commentary and said, this is the guideline, or for this case, this is the violation because the offense involved use of a dangerous weapon with the intent to cause bodily harm, and then cite to the guideline. That's what all of the other PSR enhancements do. But here it doesn't have that. It doesn't put the court or anybody else on notice. My argument would also be weak if in the PSR's recitation of the facts of the offense, there was a conclusion that said, this offense involved the evidence supports the conclusion by a preponderance that Mr. Nason was attempting to strike the deputy when he discharged the firearm, because then that's an unobjected to factual representation. But that's not in the PSR. I mean, the strongest reading, I think the overwhelming sort of impression from the record is that nobody in the courtroom recognized that this was a threshold legal question and factual determination that had to be made. It was just overlooked, and it's an essential one. And it's particularly because the trial, the government was expressly pushing these two views. I think it's fair to say, okay, it should have been clear to the district court that one of these two theories has to be elected to determine what the sentence should be in this case. And nobody recognized that. And that's procedural error that requires, it doesn't dictate what that 2A2.4 is the guideline that has to be applied. That's certainly not my argument, but it requires a resentencing for the district court to make a determination as to which of these two guidelines applies.
So doesn't Cardi also say that no lengthy explanation is necessary if the reasoning can be determined or supported by the record as a whole, something along those lines, that this sort of level of detail that you're advocating is not necessarily required, particularly when there's no objection?
Right. Cardi says that the level of detail that's required will vary, and there's less detail required when there's not an objection. That's particularly true when it comes to ticking off the 3553A factors, but just as the court couldn't say the total offense level is 20, you figure out how I got there, it can't say this is the guideline. I'm not going to explain to you why that is, either because the legal standard or the factual finding. You figure it out. That's not adequate under Cardi, and that's what happened here. I'll reserve the remainder of my time if there's no more questions.
Thank you. Now, you only have like 43 seconds, but I'll give you a couple minutes.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mina Chang for the United States. This underlying case was fairly simple. Trial took less than 3 days, and the jury returned a verdict in 2 hours. The district court handled a standard, non-complex case, and it did not plainly err by instructing the jury on the government's two charge theories of the case, admitting highly relevant third-party testimony, and determining for sentencing purposes that in shooting at somebody, Mr. Nason used a gun with the intent to do bodily harm. I'll begin by addressing the jury instructions and constructive amendment claim and then move on to the sentencing guidelines issue. There's no constructive amendment of the indictment when a generally framed indictment covers specific legal theories that are presented at trial. And here, the indictment charged that Mr. Nason fired a handgun in the direction of Deputy Hall and back. And by doing so, it encompassed both the intent to physically strike Deputy Hollenbeck and also to threaten him with a deadly weapon, with the intent to, for example, make the deputy retreat or to leave him alone. In addressing the defense's argument regarding the definition of direction, in the briefings, those definitions also cite to the direction to argue that it means aimed at. But even on the basis of those definitions, they don't say that the direction is to aim, but it's along the course on which it's aimed. So, for example, if I'm driving from here with the intent to drive to Portland, Oregon, I'm driving in the direction of Canada, even though I'm not aiming for Canada. And likewise, Mr. Nason could have been shooting in the direction of Deputy Hollenbeck, but it doesn't mean that he was actually intending to aim for him. Unless your honors have any further questions on the jury instructions, I'll move on to the sentencing guidelines. There is nothing plainly erroneous about the district court's determination that the U.S. Sentencing Guidelines Section 2A2.2 applied to Mr. Nason's conduct, and that it involved the use of a dangerous weapon with the intent to do bodily harm. So in order...
To get to the heart of defense counsel's argument, what in this record indicates to us that the district court understood it had a choice to make?
Your Honor, I believe that in the record, in justifying its sentencing decision, the district court did make finding in support of the decision that there was intent to do bodily harm. So in the record at ER 36, the district court found that that Mr. Nason fired a shot at Deputy Hollenbeck. And as evidence, the district court referenced his testimony, Deputy Hollenbeck's testimony, that he saw Mr. Nason point a gun at him, and he believed that he was being shot at. And so this is quite different from a scenario in which Deputy Hollenbeck was just obliquely in the line of fire when Mr. Nason discharged the gun. So it was reasonable for the district court to conclude that by pointing a gun at somebody and shooting it, he intended to do bodily harm. And moreover, during the trial record, it also comports with the conclusion that Mr. Nason had intended to do bodily injury. So first, Mr. Nason was aware that Deputy Hollenbeck's location in the back of the residence, that he was there because he had made eye contact with him. He had heard his voice as Deputy Hollenbeck yelled commands at him. When Mr. Nason made his way upstairs, he could also hear that Deputy Hollenbeck was shouting at him in the moment that he fired in his direction.
So given the context that the statements that you've just referenced were made, you could read that as the district court thinking about the nature of the crime and thinking about just the general sentencing factors and not specifically the application of a particular sentencing guideline. So I think defense counsel has a point to say there's very little said here in terms of other than, you know, the PSR was correct and I'm going to adopt that approach. So I'm just trying to figure out the plain error thing is doing some work here, right? Because if an objection had been made, then the district court could have made clear whether it was thinking improperly about this process or not. But I think there is some ambiguity in this record.
Certainly, Your Honor. And that's where, as you said, plain error review does come in and to do some work, because the district court did not have that opportunity to fully explain because Mr. Nason did not challenge or did not raise an objection. Therefore, it didn't have the full opportunity to explain all of these.
So the tension then is there is an obligation of district courts to explain what they're doing without, you know, that obligation exists even absent the face of an objection, right? So it's the tension of how do we think about those two rules in this particular case?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that the district court has a sua sponte responsibility to explain all the reasons why a certain reason for not applying it should be considered and not. So that shouldn't necessarily be an explicit requirement of the district court to do so. And moreover, on plain error review, even if there is ambiguity, because it's not, there might be reasonable dispute, I believe that the government would still prevail on plain error review for this point. So unless your honors have any further questions, whether that be to the sentencing arguments, the 403, the government would submit.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mr. Blank?
Well, you know, my basic argument and point is that there needs to be some hint in this record that the district court considered the definition of aggravated assault in the commentary to 2A2.2 in order for this not to be plain error. And there's just not a hint in the record that it understood that that was at play.
So if we had a situation where there wasn't this choice between two potential guidelines and there was just the one, would you be still arguing that on this record we couldn't infer that a finding for that fact was made here?
I might not be understanding the threshold to your question. If the guideline was dictated by the statutory index and there was no choice to be made, I wouldn't have an argument. But
right, but you would still have the, did the district court make the sufficient finding to trigger the only guideline on the table?
Right.
And what I'm asking is, on this record, would you still be arguing that a sufficient factual finding was not made? It seems to me that the argument here hinges on the fact that there was a choice to be made.
It does. And no, I wouldn't be making that argument because, you know, compare the argument I'm making with respect to the selection of the base offense level with the other guidelines enhancements. There the PSR says and the district court adopts, this enhancement applies because, and it cites the guideline language that makes it apply. And I think that's the minimum that's required here to survive plain error review. The court or the PSR that the court adopted needed to say the guideline for this violation of 18 U.S. Code 111 is 2A2.2 because the offense involved the use of a dangerous weapon with the intent to cause bodily harm, cite to the commentary. Each of the other guidelines enhancements, that's what the PSR does. It misstates it and overlooks it in the first one.
That's the difficulty with your argument, I think, because if we could look at this record otherwise and say that the factual findings that the district court made would trigger this guideline, and we just don't have the express statement of, I have now made a factual finding that triggers this guideline, why can't we just get there anyway?
Well, I think that's the strength of my argument, because for the court to say that the district court has provided an adequate record for appellate review, it has to explain that it's making a decision on the issue. It hasn't. And so I want to answer the argument that the district court sort of backed into a factual finding supporting one or the other. I don't think that's accurate either. But for the court to say that the district court was exercising its reason and making the decision that it needed to, it needs to have some confidence or some indication that the district court actually was considering those two alternatives, or the PSR writer working on behalf of the court that then was unobjected to. And it's just not there. The only evidence that I think that you could read as the district court is selecting the government's theory A. Mr. Nason was attempting to shoot the deputy versus theory B. He didn't care whether he hit the deputy or not. He was just trying to frighten him. Is maybe that little part of the sentencing allocution that the government for the first time has cited here at oral argument. But I think, Judge Forrest, you're exactly right. That is explicitly in the context of the district court's discussion of the 3553A factor. She says, let me turn to the nature and circumstances of the offense. And her headline, her first paragraph in introducing those arguments, and this is on ER 36, she says, Mr. Nason fired a handgun in the direction of Deputy Hollenbeck. And then she gets more specific in describing some of the testimony. But if I'm wrong on the first point, her summary of what the case is, he fired a handgun in the direction of Deputy Hollenbeck, she's not selecting between those two options, even in her discussion of the nature and circumstances of the offense. And so she has, you know, this doesn't amount to a factual finding on the guideline, I think. And even if it did, does that mean that she's recognize the decision that needs to be made, or that somebody has, even in a minimal sense, and selected between the two, aware of the decision that has to be made for that purpose? There's nothing in the record to suggest that. And that means that Mr. Nason is entitled to a resentencing on plain error review because of Carty and because of all this court's case law, that minimum explanation is required by this court's standards. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. And this case is submitted.